A little bit of legislative economics on the program today. Some conflict of interest, unintended consequences. Also, what'd you have for lunch today? And where did you eat it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryznov. Thursday, the 12th of January. Great as always to have you along, everybody. The Senate of these United States was working till the wee small hours this morning, taking the first legislative steps in dismantling the Affordable Care Act. They did it with a parliamentary maneuver known as budget reconciliation. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going with a primer.
This thing called reconciliation started back in the 70s. Congress created it to get certain tax and spending legislation passed faster, to speed up a torturous process. Richard Cogan was a staffer on the House Budget Committee for 21 years. He says reconciliation was meant to be used
sort of as a way of herding cats into a corral with known boundaries.
If you haven't guessed yet, those cats are members of Congress. Here's how it works. The House and Senate agree on a budget plan, including instructions on how much money to spend or even take in. That part is reconciliation. The bill just passed by the Senate tells certain committees to save billions, and it's understood that savings will come out of the Affordable Care Act.
The budget process has been twisted into something it was not originally meant to be.
That's Henrietta Trays of Height Securities. She says today, reconciliation has become a tool to railroad the minority party in Congress because the Senate can pass reconciliation bills with just a simple majority, avoiding any filibusters.
The real problem is partisanship. We wouldn't need to go down this road if people could get into a room and come to an agreement, and that's not happening.
It wasn't always this partisan. Lawmakers used reconciliation to work together on deficit reduction in the 80s when Rudy Penner was in charge of the Congressional Budget Office.
I thought things were difficult enough in the 1980s, but now things are really extreme.
Penner says the budget process has broken down in recent years, and now it's being used in ways he never imagined. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As we told you about yesterday, President-elect Donald Trump has decided not to put his business interests in a blind trust or to divest himself of an ownership stake in the Trump Organization. The head of the Office of Government Ethics says that Mr. Trump's plan falls well short of what recent presidents have done to address their conflicts of interest. But Mr. Trump has made his decision, which leaves this question. Now what happens? Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that one.
The public discussion about these issues has been dominated by lawyers, so you might expect a wave of lawsuits to come next.
You know, a party could file a complaint, but the court will not hear it and throw the matter out.
Rob Walker was formerly chief counsel of the Senate Ethics Committee and is now an attorney at Wiley Ryan. This is even before you get to questions of what conflict rules apply to the president or even the untested sliver of the Constitution called the Emoluments Clause, which deals with foreign government payments to U.S. officials. There's a basic legal concept of who can sue whom, explains Sam Izakharoff, constitutional law professor at NYU.
There's a formal legal doctrine called standing. And in general, if there is no particularized harm to a single individual or a single group, one can't bring a lawsuit in the abstract because something is distasteful.
Like many other lawyers and scholars, he doesn't see many likely scenarios where someone could have standing against Trump in a conflict of interest suit. And a focus on lawsuits misses a larger point, adds Washington University law professor Kathleen Clark.
There are these other ways to hold a President Trump accountable. It's just, I would predict it won't primarily be through the courts. It'll be through public opinion.
Government watchdogs, Congress, ethics advisors, and others will all work to sway public opinion on Trump's conflicts. That could be what got Trump to make the moves he announced yesterday. Public pressure could drive him further toward what the ethics community wants. This battle will rage right up to Inauguration Day and well beyond. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, enough about Washington and politics. Los Angeles is, as of this morning, a two-football-team city again. Dean Spanos, the billionaire who owns the team formerly known as the San Diego Chargers, made the move after taxpayers in that city rejected a proposal from the franchise to raise taxes to pay for a new stadium. Whether it's going to pay off? Yeah, here's Marketplace's Andy Euler.
The Chargers played their first season in the old American Football League in Los Angeles in 1960. They moved to San Diego a year later and stayed there ever since. When San Diegans rejected that tax increase in November, a move seemed inevitable. Now the Chargers will share a stadium with the Rams, who relocated to L.A. last year from St. Louis. Andrew Zimbalist teaches economics at Smith College. He says that means the two teams will share stadium revenue.
Would the owner of the Chargers, would he do better if he had his own stadium? Sure, he would do better. But it doesn't mean that he won't do better in Los Angeles than he was doing in San Diego.
In terms of the two local economies, it probably doesn't matter much. Craig Depkin, a professor of economics at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, says that's because of one of those nerdy economics terms, the substitution effect.
The substitution effect is really dominant. Much of the local spending will just be moved from one source of relaxation and leisure that is going to a football game to another source, could be going swimming or skiing or whatever else.
He says NFL franchises don't hire many people. There could be some boost to the Inglewood economy, where the Rams and Chargers stadium will open in 2019, but the place seems to be getting a presence in the nation's second biggest media market. Alan Sanderson teaches economics at the University of Chicago.
I think the National Football League needs Los Angeles more than Los Angeles needs the NFL.
He says that's because the city's two major college football teams, USC and UCLA, already have a big fan base. The struggle for the Rams and now the Chargers is diverting some of those fans to their franchises. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Apropos of nothing, whatever, a phrase I heard on cable business news this afternoon, Trump tweet risk. On the wider Wall Street today, started really low, ended just a little low. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Next week, obviously, is going to be a busy one in Washington, D.C. The Congressional Committee on the Inaugural says it has distributed almost a quarter million tickets to the public for the event. 150,000 or so protesters are expected for the Women's March the following day, which is, when you roll all those people and their money together, a business opportunity. One most readily seen, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, in the hats.
Hats and politics have always gone well together. At the inauguration, you can expect to see plenty of Trump supporters in those red and white Make America Great Again hats, but the protesters are also getting in on the political hat market.
I have a goal of making, hopefully, 5 hats a day for the next 10 days.
Allison Sogan has been selling her hand-knit hats on Etsy as part of a viral knitting project. They're called pussy hats because of their cat-shaped ears. Think of it as some old-timey trolling of President-elect Trump. The hats became so popular, in fact, that Sogan actually had to take down her posts shortly after it went up.
The first time I posted them in the morning, and by noon that day, I had 55 orders.
Sogan says she's working as fast as possible to ship the hats in time for the march. Trump's unexpected victory caused some brief concern for local hotels as Hillary Clinton supporters canceled their reservations. But those rooms were quickly snapped up by Republicans like Nick DeSegli.
You know, on election night, as soon as Hillary Clinton conceded, 4 o'clock in the morning, we were booking our hotel room and airline flights.
DeSegli is on the executive committee of the Florida Republican Party. He says he and his wife plan to attend several high-dollar GOP parties in D.C., the kind of contract any hotel or ballroom would love to have.
The governor of Florida, Rick Scott, is hosting a Florida Sunshine Ball, possibly going to the Texas Ball on Thursday night. We're kind of undecided.
While good for business, having so many liberals and conservatives in proximity to each other sometimes means walking a fine line.
Come on in to the Redwood restaurant. It's quiet now because it's a few hours before we open.
Jared Rager owns the Redwood restaurant just outside of D.C., as well as two bars on Capitol Hill. He says he's happy to welcome both Republicans and Democrats to his restaurants, but that does not include all groups with a political agenda.
You don't want to unwittingly support a group that doesn't share even remotely your same morals or sense of values.
Rager points to a local Italian restaurant that had to apologize after unknowingly booking a white nationalist event. Likewise, an Arlington ballroom is also facing backlash after declining to host the so-called Deplora Ball, a far-right coalition of Trump supporters. Still, Rager says his business is hospitality, not politics.
I mean, listen, it's not our general practice to screen events for you know, if somebody has a bad voting record, we're not going to refuse to host their fundraiser. That's not really the business we're in.
There's one thing Rager has noticed, however, away politics has been good for business.
There is more alcohol being consumed since the election across the board. Hard to say if it's celebratory or commiserating.
With so many people packed into town, getting a dinner reservation is going to be a nightmare. So whether celebrating or protesting, most people won't have the luxury of being too picky about where they eat and drink. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Intelligence operations have been in the news of late, foreign mostly, but there's all kinds of analysis and information gathering going on closer to home to our purposes today at airports and other pieces of this country's infrastructure. Jeff Mano writes about some of the new intelligence work happening here in Los Angeles at LAX, the Los Angeles International Airport, to be precise. Jeff, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Most of the traveling public, the air traveling public anyway, thinks of airports basically as fortresses, right, as big security nightmares. This piece points out that not only is that not so, but airports know it.
It does, yeah. I mean, I think as we've all seen, airports are increasingly fortified environments. They're also increasingly targets.
And what we have now here detailed in this story in The Atlantic is this idea of critical infrastructure protection sort of becoming the new intelligence focus, really.
Well, what I think is so interesting about this is that what LAX has done is really realize that they couldn't be dependent on the intelligence reports of other agencies. And so, in a sense, they realized they had to punch above their weight and bring on their own internal intelligence corps. And so they hired, two people from actually the East Coast with intelligence backgrounds with classified access to really kind of boost their ability to look at threats, not just locally or even regionally, but actually globally, and to participate in information sharing with other agencies with classified access.
One of the things that the two security specialists that you profile in this piece, one of the things they talk about is the, I guess you call it the transition zone, right? The zone between actual airport proper and the civilian infrastructure that surrounds it, hotels and highways and all that.
Yeah, that's one of the aspects of the airport landscape that really surprised me the most in terms of how troubling it can be. So, one of the things that was pointed out to me was, for example, in just LAX alone, there are 1,600 portals, they're called, which are the transition zones between public space and then the actual the space where you need a badge or that kind of thing to get into. And so maintaining that and protecting it comes down even to being in touch with local hotel managers so that if somebody is staying on the upper floor of a tall hotel near the runways, they can just open up their window and have a straight shot at a jet. You know, you need to know about that hotel. You need to know those managers. They need to know they can contact you if they've got a suspicious guest who's coming in.
Let me get you back to where we started then. And this idea that the traveling public, the perception that the traveling public has of airports as honestly a security nightmare. I imagine the airport intelligence folks and infrastructure intelligence folks writ large, they think it's a nightmare too.
They do, actually. One of the people I spoke with was a woman named Stacey Peel, who is an airport security expert at AirUp, a global engineering firm. And she was pointing out that, yes, it really is this nightmarish scenario. And most of the time, you know, you're taking something that the public interfaces with, which are the metal detectors and the passport screening and that kind of thing, and you're just shoehorning it into these little hallways or corridors where nothing like that was meant to be when the architects originally designed these facilities. You know, the good news, I'd say, is that the airport security field is very, very aware of this. And, they're trying to figure out a way to solve that problem and to get a little bit of that friction solved, you know, every year so that eventually it won't be quite as taxing as it is currently.
Jeff Mano, his most recent book is called The Burglar's Guide to the City. We had him on the program for that about a year and a half ago. His new piece in The Atlantic magazine is called Inside LAX's New Anti-Terrorism Intelligence Unit. It's a fascinating read. Jeff, thanks very much.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up,
whites without the yolks are less nutritious. The two go together.
Learn something new every day in this job, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial sloughed off about 0.3% today, 63 points, 19,954. The NASDAQ also dropped 0.3%, 16 points, 5,563 there. The S&P 500 lost 0.2%, 4 points, 2275 on that index. Bad news for Fiat Chrysler today. The EPA accused the company of rigging emission software in its diesel cars and trucks. Fiat Chrysler stock, a lead balloon, down about 18% before trading was briefly suspended. Fiat Chrysler ended things down 16% on the day. A little bit of deja vu. Yeah, Volkswagen struggling in a similar scandal. VW dropped 2.4% today. The bond market, yeah, essentially flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.36%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The current calendar of confirmation hearings has Betsy DeVos, the nominee to be Secretary of Education, taking her turn at that long green table on the Senate side of the Capitol next Tuesday, the 17th. DeVos has spent much of her career and millions of her own dollars promoting charter schools, schools that are publicly funded but privately run. Assuming she gets the job, DeVos steps into a growing debate over the place of charters in public education. From the Education Desk, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Inside a small brick row house in northwest Baltimore, 8-year-old Tyla Smith pulls on a parka, pink hat and gloves, and a huge backpack, heads out the door, and walks one block to Langston Hughes Elementary School. But instead of going inside, she walks around to the parking lot. Langston Hughes closed last year, so she boards a yellow school bus to ride a mile away to Arlington Elementary. Tyla says she doesn't mind.
Because when you walk, your legs feel tired, and when you don't walk, your legs don't feel tired.
But her mom, Naisa Page, a former teacher's aide, is legally blind and misses the convenience and peace of mind of walking her daughter to the neighborhood school down the street.
And it was a good school, small classes, everybody knew each other. It was like a family. Now, it all is, and it's okay and everything, but it's not like Langston Hughes.
The reasons Langston Hughes closed are complicated. Academically, it was one of the best performing schools in its impoverished neighborhood of Park Heights. But enrollment had fallen over the years, partly, many believe, from competition from nearby charter schools.
You are ready for 7. Yes, thank you for asking for the pencil.
About 2 miles away from where Langston Hughes sits empty, another elementary school is thriving, KIPP Harmony Academy, part of the national network of KIPP charter schools.
So we have 6 classes per grade level with 26 kids in each class.
That's almost 800 kids from kindergarten through 4th grade. Principal Natalia Adamson says it's big on purpose.
We believe our parents should be able to be educational consumers like folks can do in more affluent communities. They can choose private schools, public schools, parochial schools, like they can do that.
More parents around the country are choosing charter schools. In the last 6 years, enrollment has grown by more than 60%. More than a quarter of charter school students are African American. In the fall, the NAACP called for a moratorium on charter school expansion amid concerns the schools are diverting higher performing kids and resources away from traditional public schools without the same accountability. Cornell Brooks is the NAACP's national president.
We see all across the country charter schools expanding in ways that impoverish public education as a whole.
That position has put the civil rights group at odds with many black leaders who see charter schools as an alternative, particularly for kids from low-income families. Darrell Bradford is executive vice president of the education reform group 50 Can.
Charter schools are doing amazing work in some of the biggest cities in America for some of the kids who have the least choice and have the least likelihood of having an amazing opportunity.
Clearly, many parents want that opportunity. KIPP Baltimore has a long wait list every year. Gloria Nelson still remembers the sigh of relief when her daughter Juliana got in.
Because my neighborhood school is fine. However, it wasn't an option for me. I needed her to be challenged.
Juliana, in sixth grade now, says she is challenged.
And the extracurricular activities they have, like pre-law, it helped me discover, like, that I wanted to be a lawyer.
Wait a minute, you have pre-law?
Yeah, middle school.
About 70% of the students come from the surrounding community, but advocates for traditional neighborhood schools say it's happening at their expense. The NAACP is holding hearings around the country to debate the issue. In Park Heights, community activists are hoping to build a public library where the beloved Langston Hughes Elementary has closed. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One of the truisms of working in an office is that lunchtime can be kind of a letdown. The sad, sad spectacle of eating at your desk. The good people at Bon Appetit were talking about this the other day on their podcast, their strategies for a better desk lunch. So we asked Adam Rappaport to explain. He's the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit. He's also the host of the Bon Appetit Foodcast. Adam, thanks for coming to the studio.
Good to be here.
What'd you have for lunch today, man?
Today, well, I ordered out today. I was real busy, and I had to come.
Me.
I had to come do this radio
this
thing. Don't believe you me. As I was sitting there, I was like, "Oh, I should really be eating a bring from home lunch today."
Well, we'll talk around it. So here's the thing, and this was my thought when I was listening to the podcast the other day. You guys are foodies, and you were talking about, you specifically, actually, were talking about going to the kitchen to get your Malden salt, and then you went upstairs, and you got your, you know, champagne vinaigrette or whatever it is. And I'm like, man, I grabbed whatever was in the fridge and slapped it in my bag.
Listen, all right, a couple of things about doing a desk lunch, lunch al desco, as I like to call it. Keep a little pantry at your desk. And by that, I mean have an actual bowl or plate, a knife and fork. I like to keep a little cutting board in there and one sharp knife. I keep some decent olive oil, some Malden salt, maybe a little hot sauce of your choosing. And that allows you to sort of dress up even the most sort of mundane lunch and give it some freshness. That changes the game.
Can we talk about the office microwave for a minute, please?
Yeah. Depressing.
Yeah.
Also, and smelly.
Since I have you, let me get the official adjudication here from a food professional. What is your rule? And you might be able to gather what my rule is. What is your rule on microwaving fish in the office microwave?
No.
Thank you.
Just no. Anything seafood related, no. Also, but what we believe in, room temperature.
Wait, what?
Room temp food. So say you make something at home. We like this notion of making some stuff in the beginning of
the
week.
So
you have a bunch of like farro or wild rice or some sort of grains. You have some chickpeas. You bring those to lunch. Did work. You don't refrigerate them. Just let them come to room temperature. Then you've got maybe an independent salad dressing or olive oil. You fix them up. You slice up an avocado, some cucumbers, and all of a sudden you have a delicious lunch. Maybe you also, another thing I love, hard-boiled eggs.
Really?
You slice those open, put them in there. A little olive oil, flaky sea salt. Bam, you have like one of those fancy grain bowls that you would have your friend next to you in the cubicle paid $14 for.
All right, I'm chuckling here because the staff here at Marketplace will recognize this in me when you mentioned hard-boiled eggs. What I do sometimes when I'm looking for like pure protein and I'm feeling you know where I'm going, right?
You eat a hard-boiled egg straight?
No, I throw away the yolk. I just have the whites.
Oh,
and I do like six of them.
Are we really doing this interview?
We are. This is on the record, man.
Why? Well, first of all, what's wrong with the yolk?
Well, isn't that where all the fat is and the cholesterol?
You're living like 15 years ago. Eggs are not bad for you. It's like you sound like a healthy guy. There's nothing more complete food than an egg in its entirety. This is not the 80s, dude. I don't want to hear about the egg whites. Okay.
Now that I've eaten an egg. Now that I've bared my culinary soul on the radio. I will tell you what, it was fascinating to me to listen to this podcast, the version of the podcast and the podcast in general, because I don't actually get lunch. I have like a piece of toast or something small at like 11:30 because we go on the air at 2 in the afternoon. But the idea of making a desk lunch a thing to be looked forward to me was remarkable.
It should be. I think that lunch is one of those few things that you actually have to look forward to during your workday. And not that the rest of your job is terrible, but it's like, this is my time. It's something that I can control. I'm not in a meeting. I'm not having to deal in front of the computer. One person at the office starts doing it, everyone will follow. Someone has to lead. And I think that could be
you. Oh, God. No, man.
Or maybe not. But someone can.
Adam Rappaport. He is the editor-in-chief at Bon Appetit. Adam, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We got a whole list of Bon Appetit's secrets to a good desk lunch. It's at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of Oops. If you were watching the web feed of C-SPAN today, you might have noticed something odd. Just as California Congresswoman Maxine Waters was making a speech about SEC regulations, the feed switched over to RT, once known as Russia Today, the television network funded by the Kremlin. Twitter, as you might imagine, went bananas. Here, though, is C-SPAN's statement on the whole thing. Quote, as RT is one of the networks we regularly monitor, we're operating under the assumption it was an internal routing error. If that changes, they went on, we will certainly let you know. End of quote. So, you know, that's good. All right, we got to hustle. The Dow off about 1/3% today, 63 points. NASDAQ off 1/3%, 16 points. S&P 500 off 2/10, 4 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Daniel Irby, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.